For as long as philosophers have been, well, philosophizing, they have been wondering, what makes humans conscious? What does it mean to be conscious? But for a long time, scientists didn't pay much attention to this question.
As recently as the 1980s, the science of consciousness remained a controversial topic, seen as just a bit too out there.
That all began to change in the 1990s. Since then, neuroscientists and doctors around the world have discovered some really tantalizing clues about what's going on in the human brain to make us conscious or unconscious as well. So for this episode, I've spoken to two scientists at the very forefront of this search. Let's jump straight in. So, Emmanuel, before we get started, if you could just give me your full name, title, where you work, and generally what you study.
Hi, Daniel. Thank you very much for the invitation. My name is Emmanuel Stamatakis. I work in the Department of Anesthesia and the Department of Clinical Neuroscience at the University of Cambridge. The broad context of my work is brain injury, severe and mild. Specifically, I am very interested in brain networks, how they relate to each other in terms of activity. And I'm trying to understand how the brain works in healthy people and in brain injured people.
And much of your research has focused on the idea of consciousness. Can we define that? Because consciousness, it's kind of a squishy idea, at least to us lay people.
Okay, so the way we understand the word consciousness in everyday speech as such is the means by which I know that something is happening to me and it's not happening to somebody else. I am conscious. I can relate to the world. I can relate to what's happening around me. And I can, importantly, I can react to what is happening around me. My work has a broad clinical perspective. So we reduce, if you want, consciousness to two dimensions. One is wakefulness or arousal, so how alert someone is. And the other is awareness. So we sometimes call content of consciousness. So how aware someone is a patient of the environment. To give you an example, a healthy controlled person would be fully alert and fully aware. Somebody who suffers from what we call a minimally conscious syndrome will have normal wakefulness, so they will wake up and go to sleep. However, they will not be able to interact with their environment, so their awareness will be lower than usual.
And is consciousness a spectrum? Because certainly my plant sitting here on my desk will track the light. It is responding to outside cues, the environment around it. It will do things in reaction to other activities. So what differentiates some, I don't know if it's a lower level of consciousness, is this a continuum? You know, where's the difference there?
You are going in the direction of what we call the hard problem of consciousness. I.e., how do some organisms like humans have a sense of self and know that something that's happened to them or happened to other people, in contrast to plants? The term itself, the hard problem of consciousness, was introduced by Chalmers, the philosopher.
Manuel is here referring to David Chalmers, an Australian philosopher. He brought the mind-body problem, what he calls the hard problem of consciousness, back into the realm of mainstream research and debate when he gave a talk on this in the mid-1990s.
And basically he's saying, he's a little pessimistic, and saying that it's very difficult to understand how you go from matter, from oxygen going around in your brain and making it activated or deactivated, all these chemical processes, to the understanding that what is happening here is me having a discussion with you. And I'm aware of the questions you're asking and I'm responding to them and I know what I'm contributing and what you're contributing. There is a spectrum in all that. We define it in terms of disease in the last 100 years or so, but the definition is extending a little bit. So in terms of human patients, the lower form of consciousness would be somebody who's in what we used to call vegetative state, but the term is now unresponsive wakefulness syndrome. So somebody who who cannot communicate at all. Then we have minimally conscious people. Then we have people who receive anesthetic drugs daily for an operation they have to have in hospitals. Then we have people who are sedated mildly because they're hyperexcited about something or they're upset. So we bring their conscious level down. We numb them a little bit to not experience so much. Then we have people who communicate without any drugs, any anesthetic drugs, any sedatives on a day-to-day basis. Now, in the last 10 years or so, we started extending in a different direction where we say that there are stimulants who will increase your consciousness. There are psychedelic drugs who will, I hesitate saying this, but will increase your consciousness even more. We know that you're not exactly hyper-conscious. You can't hyper-perform when you take an LSD because there are all kinds of hallucinations you have. So we're still to explain details in there. But that is a continuum that is discussed quite often in contemporary literature.
So where did this start? Where was this first kind of research into these, you know, to understand consciousness?
Philosophically, you know, from hundreds and thousands of years, people are trying to, from the ancient Greek philosophers to more contemporary philosophers, trying to define what is consciousness, what does it mean? More recently, we tried to measure it, to capture it in terms of numbers. The MRI machine used as a tool in the last 20 years has kind of revolutionized this field of research. So look into the brain, look at how the brain activates or deactivates, and the same with EEG, actually, electroencephalography, how the brain activates or deactivates, and trying to deduce initially this idea that there is an area in the brain that is responsible for consciousness, but as we learn more, is how the relationships between different areas of the brain that tell us how conscious somebody is. And here comes complexity as an important aspect of this. So how complex are these interactions between different parts of the brain? Someone in Milan called Marcello Massimini was the first person in the last 10 years that reintroduced this idea and simplified it and said, the way maybe we can look at brain signals in the same way that we compress files in a computer. So if a file in a computer contains a lot of repetitive information, when you zip it, it becomes really, really small. If it contains a lot of variation, i.e. the information is complex, then when you zip it, it doesn't reduce too much in size. So that's exactly the algorithm they start using in brain patterns from patients who are minimally conscious or patients who are in a coma, and trying to quantify the compressibility of their brain signals, and found out that they were very easily compressed. They were reduced to very little, to a very small file, if you want, while healthy awake people didn't compress as much because their brain waves were more complex. When we try to measure consciousness in the brain, in the scale that I've just described, all the way down from patients in a coma, we saw that complexity in the brain, in brain signals, it's almost non-existent. And then increasingly, as we go to anesthesia, sedation, it increases a little bit. Healthy awake people, it increases even more. When you go all the way up to psychedelic drugs like LSD, it's the highest we have seen, we have measured. So this is in terms of complexity, which sometimes equates with consciousness.
So basically what you're saying is that when someone's unconscious or minimally conscious, there's less communication and information being sent between different parts of the brain than if someone's fully conscious. So Emmanuel, in a piece you recently wrote for The Conversation, you explained something called the default mode network, and that this has given scientists some important clues about how consciousness works. Can you explain that?
Absolutely. So when we say a network, we mean three, four, five parts of the brain that go up and down in activity together. So the assumption is, and the inference is, that they do something together. If they co-activate, they must do something together. So there were these five, six sets of areas, predominantly in the middle part of the brain, that seemed to co-activate in between tasks. When people that went into the scanner to do a task stopped doing the task, So in other words, when the task became more unconstrained and people perhaps started thinking about what they're going to do when they finish the task, or what they're going to eat after they've gone home, or what's the shopping going to be. So that's how the term default mode network appeared. So the idea was that you have a set of brain areas that are active when you don't try to understand what's happening around you, and you're thinking, you're ruminating. Now, the people who worked in unconsciousness with patients found that parts of that network were strongly disconnected. And in fact, the amount of disconnection related strongly to how unconscious somebody is. So if the front and the back parts of the default mode network were very, very disconnected, then somebody was unconscious completely. If they were mildly connected, somebody was in minimally conscious state. So there was a very straight linear relationship between connectivity in parts of the default mode network and how conscious you were. So that's how then everybody started studying the default mode network in the context of consciousness. Later on, we showed that those relationships actually extended to when somebody receives anesthetic drugs, whatever the anesthetic drug is.
I want to get into your own research now. You recently published a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academies of Science, which focused on the role that dopamine plays in consciousness. But I think of dopamine as like a pleasure chemical, something that makes you feel good and acts as a reward system in the brain. So how did you get into studying dopamine's role in consciousness?
Yeah, so this was, I'd like to say, a set of happy coincidences, this work. First of all, because I don't work with chemical substances in the brain, but my focus is how different parts of the brain activate and co-activate. One piece of research that I did trying to see how the default mode network changes behavior with anesthesia about 10 years ago produced a result in a part of the brain that's called the brainstem, which is basically the connection between your spinal cord and your brain. In this brainstem, we have area like the ventral tegmental area. Now, these are very, very tiny areas that produce most of the dopamine that is available in the brain, that is used in the brain.
So you were looking at how this ventral tegmental area, the VTA, activates at the same time or in sync with other areas of the brain?
Exactly. And we didn't have any hypothesis at this stage. We considered the entire brain. And we didn't just try the VTA. We tried a whole set of areas. We looked at serotonin. We looked at noradrenaline. The thing that we found that had a massive effect was dopamine from the ventral tegmental area, this tiny, tiny area. When we gave somebody an anesthetic drug, the VTA disconnected from the rest of the brain. They don't co-activate. They don't go up and down in activity together. When we withdrew the anesthetic drug, this connection was reestablished. And also, in people with disorders of consciousness, the more unconscious somebody was, the more disconnected their VTA was from the rest of the brain.
Okay, so dopamine in this VTA area, they are somehow connected to consciousness. What does that mean?
Basically, with this group of patients, there was almost total darkness in terms of what drug to use. We now have a possible mechanism. So what we can try is give these people dopaminergic drugs or start even clinical trials with dopaminergic drugs and see whether they help or not.
Just a note, the dopaminergic drugs Emmanuel is talking about here are any drugs that either mimic dopamine or interact with the dopamine system in some way in the brain.
So we need to pursue it and see whether we can ultimately bring people to a degree out of their coma or out of the ability to communicate or and so on and so forth.
Emmanuel, so earlier you mentioned that people who are on LSD have an increased level of consciousness, at least by some measures. Is there any research going on to look at the possibility of LSD or other psychedelic drugs as potential ways to treat disorders of consciousness or help get people out of comas or anything like that?
Our motivation into understanding how complexity in the brain changes after people have taken LSD was purely motivated by trying to understand what complexity in the brain means. There is an implication that perhaps if complexity increases so much with LSD, you can try and use it to wake up people who are unconscious. It's really, really early to make a statement like that. I think I need to emphasize that we're not suggesting at this stage that we can give people who are unconscious LSD and wake them up. That's research at its very, 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 very early stage.
Emmanuel, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, Daniel. Thank you.
So just to repeat one last time, we are, of course, not advocating that you dose someone in a coma with LSD.
No, definitely more research is needed before anyone tries that. It's interesting to think about consciousness as a continuum, though, with a coma on one end and then people on psychedelic drugs at the other.
So it makes sense that you'll want to figure out ways to move people around on that continuum. And there are early studies underway that are looking to do just that. I called up a doctor who's studying how drugs, specifically dopamine, influence consciousness. The hope is that it can help people with disorders of consciousness recover faster or better. Okay.
Okay, so here we go. Recording.
You're sounding good on the mic, so I think we'll be good to go here.
Perfect. Just to let you know, I might get a call from someone at the hospital. So if the phone rings, I'll let you know. I'll just have to answer, right?
All good. Yeah, all good, all good. Before we get into it, first, if you could just give me your full name, title, where you work, what generally you study and do.
Sure. So my name is Leandro Sanz. I'm a medical doctor. I graduated from the University of Geneva in Switzerland, which is my home country. And then I moved to Belgium to start my PhD. And the topic of my PhD is the development of new treatments for patients with disorders of consciousness.
Leandro is now based at the University of Liège, home to a big research center on consciousness and comas. The scientists there work to help patients with severe brain injuries.
We try to find out which patients are able to perceive their environment and which are not.
When doctors like Leandro try to measure the level of consciousness in one of their patients, just like Emmanuel, they're assessing two main things, awareness and arousal.
We have this sort of graph, so we put like on the x-axis, we have awareness, and on the y-axis, arousal. And you can draw the different states of normal and impaired consciousness on this graph. So for example, if you're in coma is like the worst state that you could be in. So it's really the initial state after a very severe brain injury. So you have low arousal, low awareness. If you're in a coma, you don't open your eyes, you don't react to any stimulation. And then gradually, patients usually, they recover first arousal. So they start opening their eyes, but that doesn't mean that they're conscious. It's something very hard to understand, usually for families, because you think in all these movies, the patients, they open their eyes and straight they can talk. So this is really not the real life. At least I've never seen that in my practice. So usually they open their eyes and it feels like they're here, but not all of them are able to really respond to simple commands. So it could be squeeze my hand or sometimes just look up, look down. So we test simple things to know if they're here. And sometimes they're just completely paralyzed. So maybe you've heard of the locked-in syndrome. This is the very extreme case where you're completely paralyzed, but you're fully conscious inside. It's due to some lesions in the motor system only, but the cortex, the cerebral essence of consciousness, is still fully preserved. So you're able to understand, to think, to hear, but you cannot move any muscles. So some of these patients, they're only able to move their eyes, and then we start a communication code with the eyes.
So someone comes into your clinic with either in a coma or in some sort of one of these disordered states of consciousness. So what are the kinds of interventions that you even think about?
Sure. The first thing that is very important to understand is that there is currently no guideline about treating this patient, and there is no uniformly accepted treatment or therapy that has proven, let's say, universal efficiency. Most of these therapies, they're still experimental, which means that there is an urge to find an efficient treatment. So it's a very active field, because if we find a treatment that even has like a slight improvement in all the patients, that would be a huge step forward for the treatment of these patients. So the outcome is a positive change of diagnosis. So if you transition from unresponsive to minimally conscious, this is considered as recovery of consciousness. But here we really focus on treatments that will directly act on consciousness and try to increase its level. So for example, here in Belgium, in Liège, we are specialized in pharmacologic clinical trials. So we can include patients in trials where they will receive either an active drug or sometimes a placebo if it's a double-blind controlled trial. And we see if this drug has an effect on the recovery. And the second axis we're focusing on is the electromagnetic brain stimulation, mostly a non-invasive brain stimulation, which is basically applying either electrical or magnetic current or field on the head of the patient and having modeling of the current to stimulate certain inner regions through the skull. Right. And so this is the two fields of expertise here in Liège. And of course, we collaborate with other centers that are specialized in, for example, regenerative therapies, which we don't do here at all. Mechanical therapies using ultrasound as well. And sensory therapies for now are mainly based on music therapy, auditory therapies.
Okay, so let's jump into your research. How do you know what drugs to try on someone? You said you guys are in early randomized clinical trials. You're testing these drugs. What are you looking at?
Yeah, it's a long process, and you're always building on the work of previous people. We are, what's the saying? We are sitting on the shoulders of giants. And there has been evidence that the dopamine network is disrupted when the brain is injured. And so based on this, there were initial thoughts about trying dopamine agonists, so drugs binding to dopamine receptors, to treat people with severe brain injury.
When you're talking about dopamine agonists, basically, you know, the metaphor I've had spinning around in my mind was like a shock to the dopamine system, similar to the way you'd shock a stopped heart with an electrical pulse. The dopamine system is disrupted, and you give it a big dose or something, and it kicks back into normal gear. Is that sort of what we're doing here?
So that was the initial idea. And then it's all about dosage. Mm. The brain is really something fragile. And so it needs to have some stability. And so what you said, meaning giving a big dose of dopamine once, we found out that it was not so effective because maybe the brain didn't need so much dopamine at one time. And it may need a more stable infusion of like low level dopamine. It's all very experimental. So we have a bunch of dopamine agonists because of mostly Parkinson's disease research at hand. So different were tried. And amantadine was first found to have an effect on the recovery of patients with a traumatic brain injury. This was a big placebo-controlled study led by Joe Giacino in Boston in Harvard Medical School. To come directly to my research, we came to apomorphin, which is the molecule that we're now testing in our clinical trial, because it has some similarity with amantadine. It's also a dopamine agonist, but it has aspects that are quite different from amantadine. One is that you can give it in a subcutaneous infusion under the patient's skin. So we treat the patient during a month, 12 hours a day, with a slow continuous infusion of apomorphine.
Okay, so you've chosen the drug apomorphine, which is already used to treat Parkinson's. So what does your study actually look like? What are you doing?
So we have started with the pilot study when we enrolled six patients, and we decided to have it open label. So open label means that everyone knows that the patients are receiving the drug. Nobody is receiving a placebo. This is clear. The families know that they're getting the drug. You know that we're getting the drug. And so the idea was also to get some preliminary results on the efficiency. But it's always to take with a lot of caution because an open label has no control group, right? And we find that the patients who got apomorphine had a quite better course of recovery. But of course, to prove that the effect is only linked to the drug, you need a very robust design provided to you by the randomized controlled trial. So given the very promising results from the pilot study, we have now started the next phase, which is the randomized controlled trial. We aim to include 48 patients in the study, so 24 in the control group and 24 in the active apomorphine. So if we see that we need more patients, this may still be adapted. The aim here is to go multi-center. So we are in contact with different centers in Europe.
Who are these patients? Are they coming in comas from car accidents?
So the causes for brain injury are, I think the leading cause is a traumatic brain injury. So indeed, car accidents, it could be different types of accidents. And then we have stroke and brain hemorrhage, as well as cardiac arrest. And so what we do, we see them when they get in the rehab center. So usually they are around 1 to 2 months after the brain injury, because first they are in the intensive care for usually a few weeks.
So you've moved on from that initial pilot with 6 patients to the bigger randomized control trial that you're in the middle of. I know it's early, but what have you seen so far?
What we have observed in terms of recovery, it depends on each patient, and they have very different profiles. But we feel that we have sort of 2 different responding profiles. Some patients, we feel that from the moment you put the drug on, you really see a difference and they start to be more active, more agitated also. It's not only positive things. It's positive to see people more active and more agitated, but sometimes they also have side effects such as nausea, vomiting. So this is one type of profile. And these patients then, when you stop the treatment, they can either keep getting better, or some patients, when you stop the treatment right away, you feel that immediately they stop responding and you feel the effect was really like dose dependent, right? We may be looking at 2 different mechanisms of effect here. We may have one mechanism which is direct action, like dopamine feeding on the brain networks that acts directly on consciousness, and the other mechanism could be neural plasticity induced by the drug, by the dopamine receptors, and this would be long-lasting even after the withdrawal of the agent. It's very emotional to see. I've seen last week one of the patients that was treated with apomorphine, and I had not seen him in several months because he has now been transferred to another centers in Brussels. And it's been probably a year since he was treated with apomorphine, and he was able to say hi to me, squeeze my hand, and say a few words. He was still in a wheelchair, of course, but it was very emotional to see him. I'm not saying his recovery is only due to apomorphine, but he really had a very an impressive course of recovery after we started the treatment, and it's always a very nice gratification for our work to see patients going well.
Well, Leandro, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. And please do keep us in the loop as kind of your future trials get going. We'd love to keep tabs.
Sure. I'd be happy to do that. Yeah. Thanks a lot for having me. It was a pleasure as well.
These dopamine agonist drugs are super hopeful, but they aren't the only trials that Leandro and his colleagues at Liège are doing. He's also trialing another drug called Zolpidem. It's usually used to put people to sleep, but it's shown some remarkable effects at actually temporarily bringing people with disorders of consciousness back for at least a short period of time. They're doing initial work on that drug too, to try and find out how it works and why it only works on some people and not others.
That seems to be a key thing here, that it really does depend on the patient, right?
Totally. And Leandro really put a lot of emphasis on the idea of personalized medicine and unique drug combos and how they might be really important in the area of treating disorders of consciousness.